This is Alan Cameron, interviewed by Chris Alden Lee on the 31st of January, 2013. Alan Cameron, Part 2.
Jim's appendix was not the only medical problem you were faced with. There was a dental issue as well.
Yes. Sometime after Christmas, Jim complained of... Jack complained of toothache and had a sked with Doc Jones down at the base at the Argentine Islands, and he didn't sleep the following night, and so the doc said we'd have to take it out. We did have tooth extraction instruments on base and a limited amount of, shall we call, painkillers. I can't remember what it was. Anyway, he decided he'd have it out, and it was, the doc said it's an abscess underneath one of the premolars. So it was decided that we'd do it in the radio room so the doctor could hear all that was going on. And then...
Was the doctor an expert dentist?
No, I think he'd never taken a tooth out or been present when one was taken out, but I think they had told him something about it.
Somewhere so along the line. Blind leading the blind, was it?
Yes. Anyway, we drew straws on who would do the extraction, and I got the short straw. So Mike Crockford, who's quite young compared with the rest of us, he was only just out of radio school, was the radio operator and couldn't stand the sight of blood, so we decided he would do the talking on the radio, because there was an open link to Base F, and the doctor told what to do, and so I got the Jack. Oh, sorry about that.
Do you want to answer it?
I shall have to answer it.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
It's okay. Just pick up from where we left off.
Oh, yes, so Jack sat in a chair in the radio shack, and Dave held him in the chair, and I put the extraction tool round his tooth as instructed and started. First of all, we gave him some whiskey and put some betadine tablets round his tooth to numb it. Anyway, I started pulling, and it's terrible when you're putting somebody you know very well in pain. And I pulled away for about 15 minutes and wasn't getting anywhere. And I said to the doc, I think Jack's going to pass out shortly if I don't, you know, carry on like this. And Jones said, "Oh, that's all right, you can pull as much as you like then." Anyway, the secret was to, you had to pull, not pull out of the mouth, but pull into the mouth. Anyway, eventually I got this tooth out, and we had a tin bowl. And because we knew all the bases were listening to the conversation going on, I dropped this tooth into this bowl and it made a big clang and...
Sound effect.
And it came out all right. And I said to the doctor, "Yeah, that's fine. It looks clean, complete with this root." And he said, "Root?" And I said, "Yes, it's got a long root on it." He said, "I think it should have two." Anyway, it apparently I may have pulled out the wrong tooth, but the abscess was underneath both, and it drained the tooth. So after that, we did have some penicillin on base, so the doctor asked us to give Jack an injection of penicillin. And if it bled, we may have to stitch it, but it didn't bleed unduly. But it did involve a comical incident somewhat a day later, because when we'd injected him with penicillin, I'd never injected anybody before, and the doc, I said, "Where do you want to inject him?" "And how?" So he said, "Well, you stand to attention, and where your thumb is, you can inject him there in the thigh." And he said, "You can either pinch it and put it in, or give him a slap so it kills the pain of the needle going in," because they were quite big needles in those days. And so I duly slapped Jack and injected him. But the funny thing was, the following morning, you could see the shape of my hand on his thigh. It was all bruised.
This is Jap, isn't it? J-A-P-P.
Jack, that's his German name, but he's always known as Jack. J-A-P-P, yeah.
And was it a full recovery?
Yes, yes, he was fine. A day later, no problems at all.
And that was in year one?
That was in year one. Just okay. Well, Jim was still in bed.
A double emergency?
Well, yeah. Yes, it was. Jim was in bed. Dave was on the holding Jim, Jack down. I was pulling the tooth, and Mike Crockford was relaying the what was happening without actually looking.
Can we talk about wildlife, or perhaps even domestic life? Well, you mentioned this cat. Where did it come from?
Well, it was given to me by the colonial secretary's wife in Port Stanley when we were in, after the, we went back to Port Stanley after the problem with the iceberg. And I don't know whether they had asked for one on base, or anyway, I took it back down to the base with me, and it was called Dizzy, who was a girlfriend I had prior to leaving. So it provided with entertainment.
Why did he have a cat? Was it just purely for company?
Well, most of the base had dogs and things. I think they'd asked for a cat, or for some reason we thought it'd be a good, you know, company, as it were. And she was quite interesting.
How did she cope with all the snow?
Well, stopping quite often and shaking her paws. Chasing sheathbills. Didn't go out an awful lot, really. Not as much as the Paizo, the dog, did.
And did you have cat food on base?
No, we just ate whatever we ate, yes. No special meals or anything, neither of them had.
And when the Dear John letter arrived from Dizzy...
My Dizzy, yeah.
The cat was renamed, was it?
No, the cat was still remained Dizzy till after I left. She was renamed some time later when she went back to the Falklands, I think.
Back to Bridget.
Yeah.
And she shared quarters with this dog, this mongrel dog, just the one?
Yes, yeah.
Where did that come from?
That came down a couple of years before, I think, off this old Sven Aldersven. I think had picked it up and left it on base. She's picked up in Montevideo, hence the name peso, which was a currency. But quite a happy dog, and I think she eventually went to another base. I never did see her again once I'd left base.
Was there any husky in her?
No. She was complete South American mongrel. Yeah. Black and white.
Again, good company? Or?
Yes, distraction. Used to enjoy running around in the snow. But basically indoor.
You were experimenting with a sport called skiing, weren't you, for the first time when you were down there, I believe?
Yes, I hadn't skied before, no.
How'd you get on?
Not awfully well. All right, just using them as means of transport, but not... didn't get it around to any ski jumping or bit of downhill falling. Wasn't my scene, really.
But boating was your scene, wasn't it?
Yes. I'd done a lot of boating.
What did you have on base?
We had two dinghies on base. One was a Norwegian scow, and the other was a 12-foot dinghy with an outboard. Called a scow was quite light, and you could drag it up and drag it across the ice. I mean, we used to go out to Dumas Point, I think it was, where there was a rookery, and do some egg collecting. But if you were out there and the ice blew into the back into the bay, then it was best to be in this light one, because you could pull it up over the floes and get back in again. Whereas the 12-foot dinghy was a real clinker-built job with outboards, and was really too heavy for two men to haul over ice floes.
Were there ever any scary moments with the little boats?
I don't think we had many.
So the answer is yes, you did have scary moments.
Well, we got... I can't remember being further than base that we didn't manage to get back. Okay, we didn't travel too far unless it was well into the summer and there was no ice around.
Mm. There was Dave Price talked about being fearful of whales in the area.
Well, yes, we did see the occasional whale, but I don't think, as I recall, any of them came too close into the base, because there's a shallow water. I can't recall, anyway.
And you learned to bake bread?
Well, yes, I learned to cook. Stop. Yes, we used to enjoy baking bread until somebody opened the door when it was rising.
When was the incident with the three guys on horseshoe? Was that the first or second year?
It must have been the second year, I think. We only heard through the radio that they were missing, yes. But obviously, Dave and Mike and I took more interest because it was somebody who'd come down on the boat with us.
You knew all three, did you?
No, we knew one of that lot. The other person who never came back got lost at Signy. I think two were down at on the first incident, and I think one fell in the crevasse in Signy.
Have I got? I maybe got the wrong incident here. Yeah. I'm thinking of the three men at Horseshoe who got.
Yeah, I think one of them was Stride, was it?
Yeah.
Yeah, he was on the boat, and the other, second one, was possibly on the boat we came down on.
What was the reaction of your base to this news? What did you do?
Well, you just took it in, I'm afraid. We couldn't offer any help or anything. Because we were a static base, you know. We weren't explorers like the other bases with dog sledges and travelling We were stuck at home, as it were.
When the news, well, when it became apparent they weren't going to be found again, did that affect the mood on the base at all?
I don't recall it particularly, no. I mean, we were sorrowful it happened, but I think we accepted that that was a risk we took when we, you know, accidents weren't unknown in Antarctic travel at those days. And what could you do? You couldn't radio for a helicopter or call out the Coast Guard, or you just had to accept it, I'm afraid.
You were down for 2 years on this particular base at Port Lockroy. And did you know you were going to be base leader for the second year, or was that something that came as a surprise?
It came as a surprise. I never even thought about it. I was made base leader, I think, just before Jim was flown out. But that was just, I think, a message from Sackford saying, you're base leader and you've got £100 a year rise.
Here's the armband.
For being, yes, base leader, harbour master, justice of the peace, etc., etc.
Did you, I appreciate it was thrust upon you at short notice, but did you develop a particular approach to being a base leader? Did you leave from the front, or did you always have meetings and committees? Or?
Oh, no, it was very much a democracy, yes. I just did the bits I was supposed to do, like look after the envelopes for posting for people who wanted letters with Port Lockroy stamps on them, but they were quite few compared with what it does nowadays.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. Was there a pillar box in those days?
No, we just collected them in a bag till the boat came in, and we were then posted in Stanley, I suppose.
There was a change of personnel, a couple of new guys came down.
Yes.
Whilst the first year had been almost entirely harmonious, there was some less harmonious.
Well, yes.
What's your memory?
There were two new guys came in to join Mike, Dave and myself. One was a semi-country lad who was had long hair, which wasn't quite the fashion in those days, and a ponytail. The other one was a more educated guy who'd worked in London, had a German girlfriend, and was very tidy. And those two were direct opposites, whereas the previous year we'd all been much of a similar sort of backgrounds, I guess. One of the main problems was that the gentleman with the German girlfriend's newsletters, which we used to have 200 word messages morphed down from Port Stanley. They read the letter and transmitted it in morphs to the radio operator. Now, normally on morphs, if it's in the language you know, you only need two words and you know what the next two words are going to be. When it's in a foreign language, you have to take it one letter at a time, which means it takes lot longer to put down in back into English. And the letters that the guy got from his girlfriends didn't make sense, because the person who's taking the morphs down doesn't know any German. So that caused quite a bit of friction, and he had to spend probably 10 times as much time over that one letter than anybody else's, monthly mail, as it were. And eventually, this gentleman and Mike stopped talking to each other, which is rather difficult on a base of five people when you're sitting around a table and would you ask so-and-so to pass the sugar?
Were the letters back going in German as well?
Yes.
Was there anything you as base leader could do or try to do?
Not really. They didn't want to talk and I wasn't going to make them talk. They were just different personalities, and I think, well, personally, I would have thought they might have picked this up before they got there, but maybe there wasn't any alternative replacement if they find one in Stanley who's not suitable and is a Gashan, then there's no problem. But if it's a specialised thing, then... And he didn't stay the second year, he went down to Halley Bay. But I don't know.
So was he kind of sent to Coventry by the rest of the base? Or were they both...?
Not unduly. I mean, I talked to him normally, but... Yeah. I guess Dave and Mike and I were a clique because of all we'd been through, both coming down on the boat and all the problems we'd had in the first year. I guess we were a bit cliquey together. Mm. So it may have been part of our...
Part of the problem.
But we certainly weren't one happy family, let's put it that way.
Were there other issues that you felt that you had to resolve as base leader that year?
Not unduly, I don't think, no. I mean, George wanted to put a wire rope across to the rookery so he could get across there during the winter, or when we went between the period when the ice wasn't there and we couldn't use the boats. But I persuaded them that Sackfit wouldn't allow the sort of equipment that was required to make a aerial sort of traverse across.
Like a boatswain's chair, you mean?
Well, yes, or just, you know, a rail with a slope on it, or even pulling yourself back and forth across. I guess it was a couple of hundred yards, I can't remember how wide it was, across to the rookery.
Across the water?
Mm.
Yeah.
But I didn't think that would be a safe...
So you were employing some health and safety
principles? Yes, I guess. What shall we say, taking a certain risk and being damn stupid, in my opinion.
Apart from the social side of things, second year at Port Lockroy sounds a bit dull, really, doesn't it?
Well, it was in comparison with the year before, you know, with all that had happened. It was fairly routine. The IGY was running down, so we didn't have as many... so much interpretation to do. We did a lot more skiing and radio hamming and our own personal pastimes, you know.
Tell me about the radio hamming. How far could you get?
Well, we had good, probably the best radio contacts than anybody else down there. Port Lockroy is an exceptional good receiving place. We actually had tuned into British television sound. We could hear the sound, and that was mainly because it was during the IGI was a high solar activity, and the higher frequencies didn't escape as much. They got trapped within the ionospheric layers and got round to us.
So you could fine-tune for the 6 o'clock news, could you?
Yes, we could tune for... I remember listening to the sound, you know, we'd actually knew it was on the right frequency. And it all, Lochroy was also used at one time during the Transantarctic the year before to relay messages from Fuchs back to base when they had radio communications problems.
So could you hear the archers and the Home Service?
Oh, yes, Home Service, radio, Voice of America, Russian radio. And I mean, while we were there, there was... something happened in the Lebanon. I think the Americans went into the Lebanon to do something, and you'd hear the Voice of America saying they've gone in to help, and Radio Moscow would say they'd invaded. You know, it's the same event from two different sources. We had excellent radio communications.
Did you maintain your interest in world events, or... because you were so far south, did things not seem quite so important?
Well, they didn't seem quite so important. I mean, we had to... we had good amateur radio. Mike Crockford had a contact in South Wales, and we had regular talking skeds with him, and he actually relayed messages from our parents and friends.
From your mum?
Yes, particularly from Mike. Mike had good contacts with this guy in South.
So how would that work? He would ring your mum up, would he? The guy in South?
Yes, yeah.
And tell her what you'd said?
Yeah, and she'd pass a message back. And I think Mike actually talked to his parents on the radio. I can't remember. It was all strictly not supposed to do it on amateur radio. But we did a lot of amateur radio because you'd get us, you'd put out your call sign and somebody in, you know, 20 people would answer you, particularly in America if they were on some form of competition. And you'd get them, you know, first one down to the other end of the band, I'll talk to, the rest I can't talk to, everybody at once, sort of thing. Yeah.
Were there any aeroplanes around in your final year?
Yes, I think the Kisterdan brought down aeroplanes for deception, and the hangar was built at Deception that year, I believe, or the middle year. I can't recall, but certainly when I left on the Shackleton, we went down to the Argentine Islands, and it's a Sven something was there with an aircraft on board, and the three of us were down there with the Bisco, and Sir Vivian Fuchs was on board too.
But no plane ever landed at
Lochroy. We had helicopters land, obviously to take Jim away, and when the Navy came in.
And there was the incident when two ships got too close to each other and a plane's wing was ripped
off.
That's
right. That was down in the Argentine Islands, if I recall.
Did you see that happen?
I think I was aboard the Shackleton, and it was between the Bisco and the whatever she was. Kisterdan, was it? Kisterdan, yeah.
What do you remember?
Just it was a windy night, and we... notice the following day that one of the wings wasn't sticking out from the Kisterdan. But I didn't see it or anything like that.
The two ships got too close together?
I believe so, yes.
On their moorings?
Yes, yeah.
So did he meet Fuchs on this journey out?
You're getting me back into a time... I think was the first trip I did south after.
Okay.
Was I met Fuchs, yes. He was on board.
There were five men that went lost in your time down the Antarctic.
Yeah.
Altogether, which was the worst period, I think, for...
It was a bad period, yeah. Three of them went down on the Shackleton. So I didn't know the other two. They, I think, were second-year people, as it were. Because it all happened in the first year, if I recall.
Mm. So when you came to be relieved at Port Lochroy at the end of your second year, What was your overriding feeling? Were you glad to get out or sorry to be leaving?
Well, to a certain extent, we knew that Lochroy was going to shut down and it was going to be moved to the Argentine Islands. And I toyed with the thought of going back because...
back south again?
Yes, to the Argentine as base leader. But I met this Dr. Griffiths on the Shackleton, who was having trouble with a prototype magnetometer he was had brought down with him, and he asked me if I'd give him a hand, as I was an electronic engineer, well, an electrical engineer. I don't think they had, yes, he must have had electronic, we had valves. Anyway, he had borrowed this prototype magnetometer from Cambridge University.
Mm.
And it was quite old-fashioned. It had a preamplifier with three valves in it, which you towed way back on the end of a long cable. And he kept losing strands on this multi-cord cable, so I helped him with... instead of having valves used to have heater wires, we were losing wires down this stand, so I installed a battery for the heaters for this valve instead of this set of valves in the preamp, so that we could get some results. And I got involved with helping him.
This is on the way out, is it?
This is after I got on the boat. It had some work to do further south.
Mm.
And we just towed this thing wherever the boat went. It wasn't a particularly scientific a programme as such. He was just collecting information randomly.
What was the information he was collecting? What was the thing?
Magnetic field strengths.
And gravity?
And he had a gravimeter with him, yes.
Was this early work? Was this pioneering stuff?
Yes, it was. The magnetometers, the one he had was a prototype one which had been built at Cambridge. They weren't being made industrially, shall we say. Not industrially, but scientifically. Mm. Well, they were, but by scientists in universities.
So this captured your imagination, did it?
Well, it did, because after I got back, Dr. Griffiths got a grant from NERC to continue his work and set up a geophysical group.
Do you remember his first name? D?
Yes. Douglas. He was always known as Griff.
Oh, was he? Okay, that'll do.
Yeah.
So you were invited to go south with him again?
Well, he offered me a job at Birmingham University in the geophysics department.
Okay. Tell me more.
He got a grant from NERC to start a geophysical, Antarctic geophysical marine group. So he employed a geophysicist, Peter Kennett, and myself, and we were to take this magnetometer and gravimeter back south and take whatever readings we could wherever the boat went during the summer, which we did the first year. And then the next year he got a bigger grant and borrowed some seismic equipment from BP and persuaded the Navy to let off explosives from him from the HMS Protector, so we could do some seismic work. So the second year south, we went south with gravimeter, magnetometer and some seismic equipment to collect seismic data. And we would do this whenever the ship went from one base to another. We would persuade the captain to divert course so we could get cross sections across the Scotia Arc, with a magnetometer, because that's a device that they use for getting ocean spreading, because the signals are matching each other on the opposite sides of the Earth's drift. So we started doing, whenever the boat went, say from Stanley to Georgia, we would persuade the captain to do it in a squares back and forth across the ridge to collect data.
You were dependent upon the captain's cooperation, were you?
Yes.
You couldn't command him to do it?
No. The captain was Frost.
Frosty Turnbull.
Frosty Turnbull, yes, known as Frosty. He was always in charge, but we found a method of, when we wanted to do something, getting the idea to him so he thought it was his, while talking to the cook. And he would come up to us, we'd tell the cook we wanted to do something, and then sometime later he would come and say, would it be a good idea to do this? We'd say, oh, yes, excellent idea. But in navigation in those days was purely done on speed from the ship's log and heading on the ship's course. So it did entail, when you have multiple changes of course, doing that sort of course, you don't always find the place you want heading to. And on one crossing from Falklands to Georgia, we nearly missed South Georgia. Because the only other navigation was stars in the first few years, and of course that was totally dependent on our own clear sky. So we started progressing, we got equipment improved, satellite navigation. We took the first satellite navigator down south, which you could only get readings about twice a day on. It was on a machine where you had to hand load the program digit by digit. The results would sometimes, if you put the program in one digit wrong somewhere, and that just loading the program took you half an hour sort of thing, you'd finish up in Moscow, you know.
That's because there were very few satellites around.
There were. They were only in position perhaps three times a day.
Yeah.
You know, there were only a dozen up or something like that. You know, you had to get at least three in your hemisphere at the same time to get a reading.
There's a sense of excitement in your voice about all this, as if you were really...
Well, it is, because it was an era where, I mean, one of the first things I did at Birmingham was to get rid of this valve preamp in the magnetometer we have and put in a transistor on, because transistors had just come out, you know. And so we were increasing the science, and the science was increasing as we went along.
There's a couple of incidents. You were on the South Shetland Islands. You were visiting Leskov Island, I think. Was yours the first ever landing?
Well, one of the things we were doing, this was about the second or third trip south, we went to the South Sandwich Islands. Now, we took a gravimeter wherever we went, and we would take readings every base. Any time we saw any outcrop of rock, Pete Kennett and I would get in the ship's boat and go and land and set up the gravimeter and take a reading. And we went to the South Sandwich Islands, and we landed on quite a few of them. But this one particular one is sheer-sided all the way round, and we found a ledge big enough just to stand the gravimeter on to take a reading. And we looked into it, and as far as we knew, nobody had ever landed on this particular South Sandwich Island before. except possibly a helicopter on the top, because there was no way to get up it. So any rock we saw, we would get the boat out and just get as many readings spread around as you could.
So back in Birmingham, what were you doing with the information? Were you producing maps?
Well, they were producing maps, getting data that matched up with the... to show that the social arc was in fact part of the great spreading, because we matched up results which were similar to the stuff found in the Atlantic and the Pacific over mid-Atlantic ridges. So it's all information enhancing the continental drift theories. And
which were quite topical at the time, weren't they?
Yes. I mean, that was more for the geologists and the geophysicists to do. I was involved in maintaining and looking after and trying to improve the equipment we were using all the time.
Did it always go smoothly, or were there bad days?
Oh, no, there were bad days. Some areas you couldn't take magnetic readings. You can't take magnetic readings with the particular magnetometer we had, first of all, in the tropical areas, because it depends on the magnetic field being different from the you have a coil, and if the magnetic field's in line with the coil, you don't get a reading. Mm-hmm. What happens, you magnetize the coil and all the electrons line up in that line, and then when you take that magnetic field away, they progress back to the natural state, and that's that projection gives you a frequency which is proportional to the strength of the magnetic field. So it didn't work going through the tropics until they developed ones with two bottles in at right angles, and transistors progressed, computers improved.
So in the 8 years you were doing that kind of work, you saw technological improvements?
Massive
strides.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, second year south, we, as I say, took seismic gear south with the help of Protector, which was borrowed equipment from universities and oil companies. And then we got more and more, they started making proper magnetometers for marine work.
There was a tragedy at one point, though, on the Protector, I believe.
Yes. The second year I went south, we took this gear we begged, borrowed and stole, we didn't steal it, but from universities and oil companies. And we were the listening vessel, and Protector was setting off explosives for us. And the method they used was to trail out a loop of cable, fit a explosive on the end they had on, one end they had on board, throw it overboard, and before the cable got taut, they would explode it, and we would listen to the results, and she moved further and further away from us, putting up bigger and bigger explosives, until in the end she would roll depth charges over the side. On the third year I went down, the Protector, or the Navy, said we can speed up this operation, because they were limited in the first year because they had to pull the cable back in again, put a charge on, redeploy it. They decided they could use two cables. They'd have one, while they were pulling one in, they would let the other one over the side.
So with the explosives on the end?
With explosives on. So that would meant they could put over twice as many charges, or twice as often, as it were, as they were steaming. Unfortunately, the first one they tried, which was fortunately only a small I think, £1 charge. They threw the cable over the side for the first shot of the run and said, right, we're going to fire it. And I was watching the listening device in the little cabin we had on the Shackleton. And I said, oh, got it. And then somebody came in and said, there's been an explosion on the protector. I said, no, there wasn't. It was in the water. And anyway, it turns out that when they fired the one in the water, they were still attached to the one on the deck, which was having an explosion put, explosive put on the end. And it killed two men, blew a hole in the deck.
Yeah.
And that was the end of the protector. Went offloaded with explosives as its deception. So we never saw her again that year. But we did, in fact, load the explosives onto the Shackleton and put the recording equipment on the Shackleton onto an island and record while the Shackleton went off and set explosives off. So
that was just bad luck.
That was bad luck. Yes, I think the officer who set it off got into trouble. Let's put it that way. But it was very unfortunate.
But otherwise, it sounds like it was a very successful project.
The project was, and carried on for many years after I left.
Why did you stop doing it?
Well, I got married, had two young children. And the people who were in the department at Birmingham were starting to go because the oil business had just started up in the North Sea. And I got a phone call one day from one of the guys who'd done his MSc at Birmingham saying this company he was working for, American company, EG&G, were looking for a chief engineer. Would I be interested? And I said, well, that depends. And he said, well, he quoted a figure which was about 2.5 times what I was earning as a technician at Birmingham. So with two young children, I decided I'd move.
To Aberdeen?
No, to Woking, in fact.
Woking,
yes. Well, the company, EG&G, had an office on the High Street in Woking, above a butcher's shop.
Why were they offering so much more?
Because they were an American company who'd come and set up a small unit here, and they started off with Americans, and of course, that's if they can get the whole of the oil industry at that time was virtually American. The English weren't doing oil exploration, particularly. Not on the exploring side. I mean, the oil companies were, but they were using American techniques and American companies. When it started in the North Sea, they anglicised it, shall we say.
Mm.
And the sort of money these companies were getting were, you know, a technician at a university was peanuts, really. I mean, I'd more than trebled my salary when I left the university.
But were you also more than trebling your stress and the demands upon you?
Not unduly. It involved a lot more travel, whereas I was only travelling once a year, as it were, at Birmingham, albeit for a month. Well, started off being 3 to 4 months until we started flying down towards the end of Birmingham and taking over the ship to do strict, totally scientific or geophysical work for a month or something like that. Greed, if you like.
No. I was just wondering what.
Whether
it was a because it was such a different type of work, and again, it was pioneering work. Whether you were.
It wasn't different to what I'd been doing.
All right.
Marine exploration.
Okay. But the stakes were higher, were they? Because there's a commercial end product.
Well, yes. I mean, and it was using all the techniques I'd been using, and there weren't many geophysical engineers in England at that time.
You were being headhunted. Yes.
I wouldn't say that. They offered me a job as a chief engineer.
And that you stayed in that kind of work for quite some time, because you then worked for BP.
Well, yes, the American company decided to retire from the business, and most of the people who were with them transferred to BP research station at Sudbury-on-Thames. At the time the Americans got out of it, I was in Singapore for them. And business there dropped off rapidly in exploration because both the Malaysian government and the Indonesian government changed their tax regime. And the oil companies maintained what they developed, but they weren't prepared to spend the money on exploration.
Mm.
So that work, when we went out there, we were there just over a year and a half. There were 20 survey boats working out of Singapore. When I left, I think there were one. So the work had gone.
So the redundancy came.
Yeah. Well, the people who were working in EG&G who were left in England had moved to BP, and they asked me to join them there as well.
Hmm.
Then BP decided that they weren't going to continue doing their own exploration, so they made us redundant, and five of us set up a company called Hydrosearch, which was doing the same sort of thing but acting as representatives to the oil company. So I would go off on a boat that was doing survey using all the techniques I'd been using all my life, and making sure they didn't get up to the tricks I used to get up to when I was not a consultant. So I was, most of those sort of representatives were geophysicists, but I was probably one of the few ones who came up through the technical.
So in a way, those Antarctic years or the Southern Ocean years kind of shaped the rest of your career?
Well, yes. I mean, you could say it started with radar, because it's seismics and radar and ionospherics are almost the same. They make a noise and listen to the answer, listen to the echo.
That's what we've been doing for the last couple of
years.
So going back over this career of yours, how does the Antarctic years at Port Lockroy rate? Are they a highlight of your career or just a stepping stone?
Well, I mean, it's obviously something which very few people have done, so it has to be a highlight.
Mm.
I kept in touch for various reasons with various people, people who've been writing biographies and wanted my input. Alan Carroll, Dave Price. I've written an obituary for Jack. I still get the monthly annual reports and all that sort of thing. Collected a few more Antarctic books. But it's been there in the background all the time.
Have you been back since?
No, I haven't. I had a chance. My wife a chance to go back down on a tourist boat, but I decided that if I went, and I know they only go ashore for a couple of hours, and I just couldn't face having to walk up a restricted path to the base for that shorter time, I'd prefer to remember it as it was. But my wife has been and bought photos back, and she now does lectures for the WI on on her trip south, using some of my old photographs and my experiences to highlight the changes over the year. And we donate what she makes to the Heritage Trust. So, yes, it's been there all my life.
An important part.
Yes, I think so, yes. Perhaps more so in the last few years when I had more time and to answer more questions, you know.
Well, I'm very grateful for your answers, Alan.
You're
Thank
welcome.
You. Thank you very much indeed.
Yes.